Chapter 13, Sex and Society. I start with words from a new school book for children taught in our public schools, and here's how it goes. See Jane. She is a fighter pilot. See Susan. She is a firefighter. See John. He is a nurse. See Fred. He takes care of the house and the children while Susan fights fires. Such is representative of the new readers found in our kindergartens. It is symbolic of the dogma of sexual equality that suggests that it is normal, in fact, just as normal, for women to be fighter pilots, combat soldiers, firefighters, carpenters, and for men to take on the role of traditional mothers. The basic premise of modern feminism is that aside from some minor biological inconveniences, men and women are psychologically identical. Differing male and female behavior and abilities are said to be solely the result of conditioning by their environment. In the 1960s, mainstream media and academia granted the new goddess of sexual equality a revered place beside the icon of racial equality. By the beginning of the 1990s, however, hundreds of new research studies swung the scientific pendulum back toward the recognition of innate sexual, mental, and behavioral differences. Yet the legal, social, government, and the entertainment establishment ignored them and continued on their feminist way. I was, of course, unaware of the controversy over sexual differences as I grew up in my middle-class neighborhood of Gentilly Woods in the New Orleans area. I knew girls were different in a lot more ways than just their physical appearance. At a young age, I disliked girls for their feminine ways. Ultimately, as I grew to manhood, I came to thank God for their wonderful differences. In grade school, the activities of my friends and me outside the classroom limited our intimate experience with girls. We played very rough versions of baseball, basketball, football, tag, wrestling, boxing, and other very hard contact sports. We would sometimes even play tackle football on the unforgiving black asphalt street in front of my house. Nothing could excite us more than the prospect of camping, hunting, or fishing. We wanted war movies. The girls desired love stories. We endeavored to take apart engines and toys to see what made them work, often failing to put them back together properly. Well, they wanted to dress their dolls. Our tiny toy soldiers and tanks and cannon were deployed by the hundreds in great strategic battles, while the little girls we knew focused on the acute detail of the dress and the personal fantasy lives of their favorite doll. We assembled model airplanes and cars. They were interested in making things that were pretty. While they made bouquets, we made coat hanger slingshots. While we wanted to dissect frogs and other animals and insects to satisfy our insatiable curiosity of what made them tick, they wanted to focus their love on kittens, puppies, and anything soft and cuddly, especially if it was very young and helpless. I knew one girl who was an exception to the rule. Her name was Allie Thompson, and she came out and played almost as rough as we did. She rather climbed trees than play house, and she loved my exotic pet collection of everything from toads to possums. She did, though, have a feminine side that was distinct from my friends and me, and she seemed able to move in both worlds without being perfectly at home in either one. Though as she got older, she became more and more feminine. There was no place for most girls in our boyish world. To us, they were alien beings. We made fun of their dainty and delicate ways, and even more fun of boys that acted like sissies. My sister was 5 years older, and in the same years that I was busily behaved as tough and daring as I could, and sometimes as gross as I could be, her feminine ways blossomed. Perfect timing. Our rooms were mirror images of each other in the upstairs of our Cape Cod home. But we two siblings had no harmony, in our opposites. Our clash of values led to terrible fights and battles. In those times, my sister convinced me that girls were to be avoided at all costs. Because of the countless examples in the classroom, I knew that girls were generally the best students and the most articulate when the teacher had questions for the class. As I progressed in junior high school and high school, I began to get closer to girls. Some became friends, and as I matured, others became desires of the heart as I answered the call that nature had placed in me. They captivated me with their soft curves and beautiful faces, their sweet fragrances, and the elegant way that they moved. When they spoke with such soft tones, sometimes their words would be almost hypnotic. And when I spoke of something that made me passionate, they listened more acutely than a boy ever could. The song of their femininity, with which I was so out of tune as a young boy, slowly became a wonderful melody to me. By the time I was a freshman in high school, my friends and I still saw girls as very different from us, but now they became a source of attraction, beautiful and mysterious. Teachings of sexual equality was almost as pervasive in my high school classrooms and on television as racial equality was. However, it found much less popular acceptance. In the 1960s, whites, especially those who were more educated and wealthier, seldom encountered blacks. And when they did, they were unrepresentative of the typical Negro. The lack of personal contact, combined with the pervasive egalitarian propaganda, contributed to beliefs in racial equality. Unlike the different races at the time, members of the opposite sex were ubiquitous. Easily observable sexual differences in behavior made selling feminism a more difficult proposition for us to swallow. It was obvious to most men and women that women differ from men far more than simply in sexual equipment. The establishment by the mid-1960s insistently decreed that no vital male-female psychological differences exist other than those induced by upbringing. By the 1990s, sexual egalitarians had retreated before an onslaught of scientific evidence that genetics and biology shaped the sharply different behavior of men and women, far more than simply environment. Unlike the racial question, I didn't enter the sexual equality argument with the establishment view. By the time I developed an interest in studying the subject, I had already read many books and scientific research papers on the power of genes to influence intelligence and behavior in individuals and races. It seemed logical to think that the psychological differences between the sexes are the result of genetic imprinting rather than simply social conditioning. The middle of the 1980s saw a sea change in the scientific community. Many social scientists, psychologists, biologists, anatomists, physiologists, and geneticists released important new studies detailing the powerful and inherent sex differences in behavior that go far beyond those dealing simply with procreation. The evidence was so abundant that it even began to seep into the popular culture. People began to reference men and women as being right-brained and left-brained. Differences between the psychology of men and women were not nearly as important to me as the race question. Still, it was a fascinating subject and one that has a great bearing on our lives, our values, our attitudes, politics, and of course, our evolutionary development. Next section, brain sex. With the development of the modern computer, electron microscope, and other technological advances, genetic research and understanding increased dramatically. Later breakthroughs such as MRI, magnetic resonance imaging, ultrasound, CAT scans, and electric impulse imaging have given scientists the opportunity to precisely measure the size, the architecture, and even study the functioning brains of living people. Although it was initially politically incorrect to study racial or sexual differences, the exploding genetic knowledge and understanding has inexorably led to greater knowledge of inherent sexual and racial differences. An example of how adjacent studies led to understanding of sexual differences is shown by the research of psychologist Herbert Lanzel in Bethesda, Maryland. In studying the patients who had experienced brain surgery, those who had part of the right hemisphere removed displayed strikingly different psychological effects than those who had part of the left hemisphere removed. Lancel and many other researchers proved that the left side of the brain more influences verbal skills, such as reading, writing, and speaking, as well as the orderly processing of information. People who suffer injuries to the left side of the brain often have difficulty speaking and processing information in an orderly fashion. Those who've had damage to the right side of their brain lose their sense of direction, their spatial understanding, and their ability to do well on abstract intelligence tests. They often get lost, sometimes even in their own homes. The right side of the brain processes visual information and spatial relationships. Lanzel found that when the left hemisphere of the brain was damaged, men lost most of their language skills, but women kept most of theirs. Men were, in fact, 3 times more likely to lose their language skills than women who were injured in exactly the same area of the brain. When men suffered damage in the right side of their brains, they lost their abilities, as demonstrated in abstract IQ tests, while women were only slightly affected. By the way, the documentation on this is available in my printed book. I hope, again, that you order that, and I hope you're enjoying this free audio version. You can go to my website, davidduke.com, to order this book for yourself and hopefully your friends and family. Let's go on. What the research indicated was that while each side of the brain focuses on certain skills and activities, men's brains are more divided and specific in function. In women's brains, both sides of the brain engage in spatial and verbal function. In recent years, there have been many studies that have mapped distribution of electrical activity in the brain while performing certain functions. They consistently show men having electrical activity primarily in the right side of the brain while taking abstract tests, while the electrical activity in women is more balanced in both hemispheres while taking the same tests. One factor in this differentiation is the corpus callosum, the tissue that connects the two hemispheres together and handles their communication with each other. It is consistently bigger in women in relation to brain weight and has more connections. Research has shown that fluency and articulateness correlate with the number of connections between the hemispheres. The more connections, the more fluency. Such affords a biological reason as to why in countless studies women have shown superior verbal skills to men. Understanding the brain differences between men and women helped me to begin to understand the deep psychological differences between the sexes that are reflected in varying talents, abilities, and even different attitudes toward life. Looking into behavioral differences between the sexes, I studied the physical differences of the brain first, and then the psychological ramifications. It became obvious from the outset that the differences between the average male and female brain of the same race are far less dramatic than between the brains of the average white and black of the same sex. However, the clear sexual distinctions in function and architecture of the brain result in clear differences in mental abilities and personality between the sexes. It is now accepted that women exceed men on the verbal parts of IQ tests, and men show more ability in the abstract parts of the tests. In higher mathematics, the difference is striking. In the largest survey on the subject ever conducted, Dr. Julian Stanley and Dr. Camilla Benbow grouped mathematically brilliant students by sex. Boys were 13 times more likely than girls to be found in the highest category. On the other hand, girls had strikingly greater superiority in verbal skills. Girls speak earlier than do boys. They perform better in reading, writing, grammar, spelling, and punctuation. They are more fluent and better communicators. Boys suffer almost exclusively from speech defects such as stuttering, and they outnumber girls almost 4-to-1 in remedial reading classes. Women are also better at organizing and putting an orderly sequence to events and objects. Dr. Camilla Benbow did not want to discover such results on sexual differences. She now, however, believes in a biological basis for the difference. After 15 years of looking for an environmental explanation and getting zero results, I gave up, she says. And that, by the way, is a quote. After 15 years of looking for an environmental explanation and getting zero results, I gave up. The most obvious difference between the sexes, other than their reproductive systems and body types, are the descriptions of character referred to as masculine and feminine. In the closing years of the 20th century and the upcoming years of the 21st, scientists are making discoveries that offer strong evidence that genetics and other biological factors are the primary forces that determine the differing behavior of the sexes. They show a strong biological component in homosexuality, sexual deviance, and the disparate sexual behavior between men and women that causes marital disharmony. In an earlier chapter on sexual evolution, I discussed the fact that the evolution of the black race in Africa led to a different set of imperatives for black males than for white males in Europe and Asia. In Europe, evolutionary forces favored the genes of males who protected and provided for their mates and children. The harsh climate of the ice ages also favored the nuclear family rather than the polygamy of sub-Saharan Africa. Because of women's dependence on males in the cold climes, women who were less sexually promiscuous and more selective also had a greater chance of survival. If they more easily gave up their sexual favors to an uncommitted male, their genes and that of their children were far more likely to die in the incredibly harsh conditions. Fundamental differences between the brain architecture of men and women lead to sexual attraction, and also to societal and familial difficulties. For the race to survive, men needed to have a natural sexual attraction for the females and the women for the males. So each sex has an inherent difference in the brain structure that causes the male and female brain to find attraction in the characteristics of the other. Because of the division of labor between men and women, men hunting, women gathering, and child rearing, the brains between the sexes evolved to facilitate those talents. Hunting requires more spatial skills, while mothering requires more verbal skills. Hunting requires aggression, individualism, and risk-taking, while mothering requires a whole set of special talents, such as altruism, risk avoidance, and individual submission to the needs of the child. If we understand these genetic drives, behaviors, and talents forged by millions of years of evolutionary development, then we can begin to understand the fundamental differences of men and women in many areas of modern life. Next section, XY, XX, only part of the sex story. In my high school biology class, even the most inattentive students took an interest when the teacher turned to sexual reproduction. Even the most academically challenged of the students learned that when a mother's X chromosome matches with a Y chromosome from the father, the child will be a boy. And when the father's sperm fertilizes the egg with an X chromosome, it will be a girl. XX equals a girl, XY equals a boy. Science over the last 30 years has shown that the above is not necessarily true. If a genetically male XY embryo is deprived of male hormones, the newborn baby will generally look and behave like a female and even resemble a female in sexual organs. And if a genetically female XX embryo is exposed to large amounts of male hormones, testosterone primarily, it will generally look and behave like an almost normal male. Near the age of 6 weeks, the sex of the fetus is programmed. If a male, the blueprint of the fetus produces cells which manufacture large amounts of testosterone and other androgens. These hormones combined with DNA direct the construction of the child, much like a toy manufacturer molds a doll or toy soldier. If a female is genetically program, the machinery produces a very small amount of testosterone, and the fetus develops female, and a girl is born. Whether or not the fetus develops into a male or female depends mostly on the presence or lack of male hormones, primarily testosterone. Actually, the natural brain is female in its basic form, and only the bathing of the fetus in large amounts of male hormone can change it to a male-structured organ. Male hormones at the 6-week stage of the fetus are about 4 times the amount normally seen in childhood. It also peaks again at puberty. When the threshold changes of the brain take place, testosterone levels increase vastly for the male. The amount of testosterone introduced into the fetus, as well as the timing of its addition, can dramatically affect both the physical structures of the sex organs and the brain architecture. A male fetus may have had enough male hormone to be born with male sexual organs, but not enough to pattern the brain in a male orientation. When this occurs, the child becomes male in sexual organs and physical appearance, but the brain is female. From the brain's point of view, it is a female trapped in a male's body. On the other hand, a female fetus could develop female sex organs and then receive amounts of male hormones that could end up constructing a male-patterned brain, a male brain trapped in a female body. The process can be shown in a number of studies that have been done with laboratory white rats. In the genetic sense, they are not all that far away from humans on the evolutionary continuum. They have brains and a central nervous system, similar reproductive systems and sexual organs, and testosterone. It is easy to study the hormonal effects on the developing brain in rats because they are born helpless with a minimally developed brain. The newborn rat brain is in a stage of development that corresponds to a human fetus just a bit older than 6 weeks, the critical time when sexual identity is established. When scientists castrate a newborn baby male rat, he becomes essentially female. He develops the characteristics of the female brain. In female rats, the left side of the brain is thicker, and in males, the right side is thicker. The hypothalamus has a distinct male and female pattern, and the different sexes have different lengths in the nerve cell connectors and the pathways to different parts of the brain. Not only does the brain of the genetically male castrated rat develop the structure of the female brain, but his behavior mimics that of the female rats as well. He becomes markedly less aggressive than typical male rats, and he will groom other rats in the female pattern. On the other hand, when scientists inject a newborn female rat with male hormones, the brain cells developed into the male architecture. The masculinized female rat will adopt male behavior patterns and attempt to mount females. She will show male-like high aggression levels. Researchers produced an almost identical result in rhesus monkeys, mice, and a number of other animals. When they inject male hormones into pregnant mothers at the same stage of development that corresponds to the setting of the human embryo brain, genetically female monkeys form male-patterned brains, and later male behavior patterns of aggression and sexual behavior. Upon injecting pregnant mothers with female hormones, such as estrogen, which tend to block the male hormone in the fetus, males are then born with the female brain structure and show female behavior patterns. The same results can be seen in the numerous children of human mothers who have had abnormal amounts of male hormone at the time of the development of their fetuses. Brain. Male hormone in greater or lesser amounts than normal can come from a number of different sources. The most common can simply be that the fetus hormone production can be genetically faulty. The hormone-producing mechanism of the fetus itself can also be affected by drugs or diet. In addition, male hormones or female hormone blockers can themselves be introduced into the fetus through the mother's hormone production or by the taking of drugs or medications. A major source of anomalous hormone levels is adrenal or ovarian tumors of the pregnant mother. Scientists have tracked the development of children who were born to mothers who have had medical conditions that produced abnormal hormone levels or who took medications that could have affected the hormone levels in their developing child at its fetal stage. The evidence from such studies is dramatic. A condition in women called adrenogenital syndrome results in the production of male-like hormones. Pregnant women who have this condition have had genetically female babies born with normal female organs, but sometimes underdeveloped male organs as well. Surgery can easily remedy the male anomalies, but the brain has often developed along male lines, resulting in typically male behavior. Girls born with this condition are typically more aggressive, seek the company of boys rather than girls, shun dolls in favor of toys or cars or trucks or building blocks, have little interest in feminine clothes, and exhibit slower development in reading and writing skills. What study after study reveals is that what are traditionally described as gender roles of men and women have such a strong biological base that they often supersede a powerful environment. And then in the next section, I tell you the very fascinating story of John, who became Joan, who became John. In 1973, sexology researcher Dr. John Money, in a well-received and much publicized research paper, argued that gender roles are plastic and formed chiefly by conditioning. His paper centered on an anonymous child whom the researcher referred to as John. When John was only a few months old, he required an operation to repair a botched circumcision. The operating surgeon accidentally amputated John's penis. Under the doctor's advice, the parents allowed them to make the child into a girl, as is often done in similar cases, because it's easier to fashion female rather than male genitals. The doctors removed his testicles and remaining penis and surgically constructed a vagina. John's parents raised John as a girl. They changed his name to Joan, dressed and raised the child as a girl, and even gave her female hormone treatments, never telling her the truth about the tragic accident. Even female psychiatrists were engaged to help reinforce the child's feminine identity. Dr. Money wrote a paper about the child and, ignoring a number of warning signals, reported that at an early age, how he, now a she, had adapted well to the new gender role with the strong conditioning of the parents. Feminist researchers, writers, and the popular media cited the case of Joan as glowing proof that gender roles were purely the result of environment rather than biology. In 1997, Dr. Milton Diamond of the University of Hawaii, Manoa, and Honolulu, and Dr. H. Keith Sigmundson of the Ministry of Health in Victoria, British Columbia, published an in-depth follow-up on the case of John turned into Joan. They revealed a startling turn of events in Joan's development. Even as a child, Joan repeatedly attempted to urinate standing up. Her mother tried to show her how to put on makeup, but she wanted to imitate her father shaving instead. She rejected dolls and dresses. She sought the company of boys rather than girls. At the age of 12, she was given female hormones and grew breasts. She grew increasingly and intensely unhappy and considered suicide. Finally, with no knowledge of her real sexual identity. At the age of 14, she refused to continue the hormone treatments and simply refused to live as a girl any longer. At that point, her tearful parents told her of the surgeon's tragic mistake. Although she was understandably bitter, her dominant emotion was relief. She said, "For the first time, everything made sense and I understood who and what I was." Joan changed her name back to John, requested male hormone shots, had a mastectomy, and ultimately a phalloplasty to fashion a penis from skin grafts. John later married, adopted children, and is quite well adjusted for the ordeal that he went through. Next section, the origins of homosexuality. Mainstream psychology once portrayed homosexuality as a product of youthful sexual experiences, parental attitudes and behavior, even order of birth. Both the academic and popular literature were so rife with this environmental explanation that parents of homosexuals often asked the question, "What did I do wrong?" They thought that their sons' or daughters' homosexuality was a result of something they did or did not do in their child's upbringing. Just as biology has explained female and male patterns of behavior, so it offers the most powerful explanation for sexual preferences as well, while acknowledging that environment can obviously play an important role. The pioneer in developing knowledge of the biology in mate selection was Dr. Günther Dorner. He discovered that sex-related aspects of the brain are laid down sequentially. In studies of rats, he found that the later the rats are castrated, the less feminine they become. On the other hand, female rats are masculinized by the introduction of male hormones at different stages of their early development. After meticulous and detailed study, he concluded that there were three levels of sexual development. He calls them, one, sex centers, meaning the sexual organs themselves; two, mating centers, that's the area of the brain which affect the choice of mating partners; and three, gender role centers, the areas of the brain that determine typical gender behaviors and skills, such as spatial versus verbal skills. Each center of development can be dramatically affected during its stage of maturation. In the mating center level, the sexual mating preference is established. Evidence suggests that this takes place primarily in the brain's hypothalamus. The final stage of development is the gender role center that determines the architecture of the brain, and this center affects levels of aggression, verbal and spatial skills, and individualism or group ethics, and a host of other differences similar to that of men and women. In terms of sexual preference, Dorner found that the hypothalamus of the male homosexual physiologically behaves in precisely the same way that the normal female hypothalamus does. When injected with estrogen, the hypothalamus of females responds by producing more of it. In male heterosexuals who are injected with estrogen, there is no production of additional female hormone by the hypothalamus. However, in male homosexuals injected with estrogen, there is production of more estrogen just as in the normal female. This would seem to provide strong evidence that the area of the brain that is most concerned with sexual mating preference is physically different in many homosexuals. There are many other studies that explain the biological role in most, but not all, homosexual behavior. One study investigated on a long-term basis 136 children whose mothers had treatment with female hormones during pregnancy. Again, the documentation for all these studies is in my book in excellent citations and footnotes that you can find, look up, and check out for yourselves. Those children had double the probability of being unmarried as those whose mothers were not so treated. Studies of the girls who experienced high levels of male hormones in the womb reveal more male typical behaviors, such as rejecting dolls, and later in life, they have a far greater likelihood of bisexual and homosexual behavior. Even stress in the mother can reduce the amount of male hormone in the male embryo. Female rats that are subjected to severe stress have male offspring that are attracted to other males. In people, corresponding periods of stress occur at times of war or devastation. In a study of male children born in Germany during the Second World War, homosexuality is found to be more common than in males born in peaceful periods before or after the war. The highest rate of male homosexuality is found in children conceived and born in the most devastating and stressful period of the war, during its last few months. The sexual centers hypothesis also offers an explanation for some typical forms of homosexual behavior. Most homosexuals take the same promiscuous view of sex as many heterosexual men. They see sex as an end in itself, not necessarily as an adjunct of a loving relationship. The male brain patterning, coupled with the female mating preference for men, frequently results in inordinate numbers of sexual partners, with the average homosexual having many more sexual encounters with different partners than heterosexual men have. The male imprint of the gender role is still prevalent, but the mating center, probably related to the hypothalamus, is abnormal. Of course, some homosexuals are effeminate and display more normal feminine behavior patterns. In these homosexuals, the gender as well as the mating center have been affected. Arriving at an understanding of the biological factors in homosexuality affords an explanation of why it and other sexual aberrations are much more common in males than females. When one understands that the basic brain is in fact female, and only the introduction of male hormones can transform it into the male form, it is obvious that much more can go wrong in the developing male brain. If little happens hormonally to the female brain, it will develop normally. It is no wonder why males are much more likely to become homosexuals than women are to become lesbians. Males are also far more likely to be transvestites or embrace other forms of extreme sexual deviance. Next section, the future of homosexuality. Research shows that biology is not the only factor in homosexual or other kinds of sexually deviant behavior. There are certainly some homosexuals who have no abnormal hormonal imbalances, and there are many well-adjusted male heterosexuals who have a female-based brain wiring as a result of abnormal hormone levels in the fetal stage. But it seems rather clear that tendencies toward homosexuality are rooted at least as much in biology as in conditioning. The homosexual brain pattern is the result of abnormal hormone levels at the time of the development of the brain structures that affect mating preference. The source of these hormone levels can come simply from the genes that affect brain architecture, or from the genes that affect delivery of the hormones that influence that architecture. In addition to the genetic factors in the fetus, the hormone levels at critical stages of the fetus can be affected by hormonal conditions in the mother's system. These conditions can be determined by the mother's genetic makeup or from pathology, diet, or medical treatment. The homosexual community has enthusiastically greeted the scientific news showing the influence of biology in homosexual behavior. Their argument is that homosexuality for them is a natural condition and that they should not be faulted for doing what seems normal to them. Some of the religious right see the scientific news as a threat for exactly the same reason. They do not want to accept the idea that God has made some people who are biologically oriented to homosexuality. Yet it must be bluntly acknowledged that God also allows some people to be born with the genius of a Shakespeare or with profound brain damage. Some humans are born with horrible diseases, while others keep their health to old age despite unhealthy habits. Because some people are born with a homosexual tendency does not necessarily make it natural or normal as far as the species is concerned. It may be normal for them, yes, but not normal for human behavior and societal values. For some, criminal behavior is as natural an expression as musical talent might be to another, but criminal behavior is certainly not desirable in a society. I am not equating homosexuality with criminality, but there are obviously many inborn traits that can be hurtful. Just because a trait is inborn doesn't make it necessarily healthy or normal. Until 1973, the American Psychiatric Association referred to homosexuality as a mental disorder, a problem to be treated as one might treat schizophrenia. By the way, my book shows in a footnote that homosexuality is often treated as a secondary symptom for severe mental disorders such as schizophrenia. It was only recently, in 1990, that the INS, Immigration and Naturalization Service, changed its policy that considered homosexuals undesirable visitors and immigrants. Even though psychologists have some limited success changing the sexual desires of homosexuals, they have had more success with simply helping them cope with it than changing their attitudes. Homosexuals, on average, die decades younger than heterosexuals from a host of maladies. They suffer mental problems ranging from depression to psychosis. They have suicide rates many times that of heterosexuals. Homosexuals and other types of sexual deviants are overrepresented in crimes such as mass murder, child seduction, and molestation. Male homosexuals have seduced and abused millions of underage boys. Their unclean sexual habits and ultra-promiscuous lifestyle have resulted in spreading the worst communicable plague in recent centuries. The specter of AIDS, which has not only killed millions of their own, but also millions of others, including tens of thousands who contracted the virus from blood transfusions. It is undeniable that irresponsible homosexual behavior fuels the havoc of AIDS. The epidemic should be viewed as a horrific scandal and a source of shame to the so-called gay community. Instead, AIDS activists condemn heterosexuals for not doing enough to find a cure for AIDS. The gay disease has also led to medical and other costs that have extracted billions and billions of dollars from the economy and a disproportionate percentage of the medical research dollar. AIDS research, with its politically correct and trendy status, has diverted research money that's needed for diseases and conditions that afflict far more people. For example, the American government spends more on AIDS research than it does for research on cancer, a disease that millions more suffer from and die from than AIDS. And few cancer victims are ever given the chance that homosexuals have had. For AIDS victims typically contracted the disease by irresponsibly engaging in clearly high-risk sexual conduct. All this from a virus that could have been stopped in its tracks by simple responsibility, and a change in conduct among homosexuals themselves. Instead, many homosexuals continue to promote publicly their promiscuous lifestyle in often sexually immodest gay parades and confabs. The raw truth is that homosexuality is damaging, devolutionary, unhealthy, and unaesthetic. It leads to disease, maladjustment, suicide, and a host of other social ills. Saying that it is natural to those who practice it does nothing to alleviate its maleficence. One could argue that smallpox is natural and therefore shouldn't be impeded, or even that HIV/AIDS is a life form that is also one of God's creations and we have no right to inhibit it. I sympathize with the unhappy predicament of homosexuals, and I am saddened by their loss of health, of happiness, and life. Although homosexuality is often portrayed as a harmless lifestyle, when its superficially humorous characterizations are put aside, homosexuality is a behavior that often damages both its participants and society at large. Chapter 13, Sex and Society, will continue on in the next part, which will be found on the next MP3 in this audio edition. I will continue the discussion of homosexuality, then talk about basic sexual differences and the attack on the foundation of both our society and our race, the family.